we'd cleaned up, Franco suggested we go out for a walk and had brought me to this garden in the middle of the city. They were in my father's old bedroom. They were tucked in Torres's first book, Death by Exile. I handed him the picture of my dad and Valentina at the beach. See? She's wearing this stone pendant. I lifted the necklace from under my shirt, having put it on for the first time that morning. It had belonged to Valentina. My mother. A wave of anxiety gripped my chest, but the necklace felt strangely soothing, and the stone was warm in my fingers. Franco examined each photograph carefully. When he flipped over the picture of Valentina standing between my father and Maximo in front of the law school, he read the inscription out loud.
Dear Santiago, all's fair in love and war. Your friend, Maximo.
Grace, the woman in New York I told you about, mentioned Maximo. Apparently he was a close friend of theirs, I explained. He held the photo out at eye level.
See how they're standing?
I had looked at the photo countless times, but now it was plain to see that Valentina's body was against Maximo's. From the way they're positioned and from the inscription on the back, Franco continued,
I would bet that your father and Maximo were fighting over her. And for once in his life, I don't think your father won.
He gave me back the photo. I scrutinized it. Might Valentina have also been with Maximo? I nod on my cheek, disturbed by this possibility. A man sat on the bench across from us. He had a newspaper open, but his head seemed tilted in our direction. Is it possible that Valentina dated Maximo after she and my dad broke up? I showed him the photo taken at the ranch. Maximo is also in this one with my parents. He's sitting next to Valentina. See? After a pause, I continued my train of thought. But what I don't get is why my father would keep the photo of the three of them. Wouldn't that memory be unwelcome if he did lose her to Maximo, as the inscription seems to imply? And what was my mother's role in this? Presumably she doesn't know my father continued seeing Valentina after they got married. During my sleepless night, I had come to the conclusion that I was his love child with Valentina. Why else would he have raised me? I could sense myself unraveling under the enormity of this revelation, and I had to will my mind to brush emotions aside, to hang in there for a little longer.
All good questions, Franco said.
The man across the path lowered and began to fold up his newspaper. And we should find the answers to them, I declared with new resolve. Franco abruptly collected the photographs. He grabbed my bag and lifted me up by the elbow. What's going on? I asked as he rushed me through the gardens. Why are we going so fast? You're hurting my arm, Franco. He only relaxed his hold when we exited the garden onto the bustling avenue. We hurried across the crosswalk as the pedestrian traffic light was flashing red, then walked a couple of blocks farther until Franco stopped and looked behind us. Franco, talk to me. You're freaking me out.
The man on the bench with the newspaper. I recognize his face. He's one of their goons. I've seen him at a few demonstrations. He's been following us.
I looked around, but all I saw were families out for a leisurely Sunday stroll.
We lost him, for now. But it's obvious they're keeping an eye on you. On us.
He placed his hands on my shoulders.
Paloma, what do you want to do? It could get a lot worse.
His words frightened me, not knowing what to do or say. I looked at Franco. He had been through so much in his life, and yet he was willing to help me, even as my circumstances seemed to have taken a dangerous turn. A strange calm descended on me. I haven't conducted a thorough search of my father's bedroom, I said, taking his hand and pulling him along. I think it's time.
Chapter 38, April 1976.
Que los cumplas, Constanza. Que los cumplas, feliz. The Larrea family and friends sang happy birthday as Lila brought out a merengue cake for her mother-in-law, who was turning 60. Bautista had surprised everyone by flying in at the last minute. Constanza was radiant, her husband and her firstborn by her side. Santiago snapped photos. It was warm for a fall night in the southern hemisphere. Street noise rarely reached the Larrea's penthouse, and the large sliding windows in the living room had been opened onto the balcony for guests to smoke and take in the views. As Constanza leaned forward to blow out the candles, Santiago saw Máximo over her right shoulder, across the dining room and in the front hall. He was talking to Antonia. What was he doing in the Larrea's home? Máximo spun his head toward the dining room, wild-eyed. Santiago felt the hairs on his neck rise. Máximo has come to kill me, he thought. Valentina told him about the affair. He put down the camera and made his way around the crowded table. He would intercept him before the others saw him. The housekeeper and Máximo turned to him as he entered the hall. Thanks, Antonia, Santiago said, and she returned to the kitchen. He studied Máximo's face, trying to get a better read on the situation. Che, how are you? Santiago asked with a strained smile. I'm sorry to bother you here at your parents'. I didn't know where else to find you. How did you know I was here? I've been watching the front building entrance for the last 2 nights. What's going on? He pivoted his body to block Maximo's view of the gathering. Can we talk somewhere private? Sure. This way. When he took his friend by the arm, Máximo showed no resistance, following him to the back of the apartment by the maid's quarters. Has Valentina been in touch with you? No. Why? Santiago asked. I've been away, and when I came back, she was gone. Did you call her parents? She's probably with them in Córdoba. Santiago remembered her plan to return home. How she asked if he would come with her, leave everything behind. That had been 6 months ago. I did. I didn't want to worry them at first, but I finally had to talk to them. She's not there. She's been gone more than a week now. They're coming to Buenos Aires to file a missing persons report with the police. You mean you haven't done that yet? Santiago looked at him incredulously. Máximo looked down, despondent. I'm the one they're after. Can you help me? Santiago was shaking his head in disbelief when Máximo said, Please, I need your help. She's pregnant. We're having a baby. Santiago heard footsteps behind him. Without thinking it through, he said, Can you get yourself to El Pinar? I'll tell Sanchez you're coming. He'll hide you until I figure something out. Take this money. He opened the service door. Máximo, folding the pesos into his pocket, stepped into the dimmed black stairwell. Gracias, hermano. I'm not your brother, Santiago hissed and shut the door. Honey? Lila's sweet voice jolted him back. When he turned around, his expression was serene. Was that Máximo? Mm-hmm. Why didn't you invite him in for a slice of cake? He got himself into a difficult situation. Needed to borrow some money. He wasn't in the mood to be social. Is he going to be all right? Santiago thought to put his arm around Lila as they returned to the dining room, but realized she might feel his jittery nerves beneath the skin. I told him he could count on me.
You've always been so kind to Máximo and Valentina.
I'm not kind, he said, beginning to lose his composure. Valentina was missing. He must find her. She was in trouble, and she needed him. He had to tell Lila, someone, anyone. But when he opened his mouth to speak or scream, Lila reached for his face,
and kissed him. Yes, you are, Santiago.
A woman's voice was barking at Valentina to get out of the car. As she was yanked out by her arm, she thought her shoulder would come out of its socket. A hand shoved her down a staircase. Her hood was removed, and she was left to drop on a cold cement floor. A dank chill hung in the room. When her shaking subsided, she squinted into the faintly lit corridor. She made out a sign. Silence is health. Opposite her, another wooden sign read, Avenue of Happiness. A guard motioned toward a closed door at the end of the corridor.
Get up. They're waiting for you.
She was handcuffed, making it difficult to stand up on her own. After a few feeble attempts, the guard grabbed her under the armpits and jerked her up. He tied a blindfold around her eyes, plunging her once more into darkness. Valentina's body moved an inch to the right, and then an inch to the left. Both times she hit something cold and metallic. When she lifted her chest, she pressed up against the same cold surface. And then she heard the others. The moans and cries came from above, below, and either side of her. A bit of artificial light penetrated her blindfold. She was not fully entombed. At least her head stuck out, she thought, with stupid relief. A whimper escaped from her lips.
Shh. It's okay. It's going to be all right. Shh.
The consoling sounds came from her right.
There, there, now. Are you badly hurt?
Valentina turned toward the voice.
I don't think so. Take some deep breaths.
Valentina tried, but her chest hurt too much. Someone had punched her repeatedly between her breasts.
Try again,
the woman's soft voice urged her. She managed one full, noisy intake.
That's better, the voice said. Looks like we'll be neighbors. Tell me, did they bring you in alone?
Yes.
So no one knows you're here?
No.
I was picked up off the street.
I had just left my studio.
She began to cry.
Shh, shh. We don't want them to hear us. Breathe deeply, again.
Valentina soon grew drowsy and fell asleep, dreaming of her home in Córdoba. She was lying in her favorite hammock among her mother's flowers. But construction noise and the rat-a-tat-tat of the jackhammer disrupted her peaceful afternoon. She was falling to the ground when she woke up.
What is that?
She asked in a loud whisper.
It's nothing, her neighbor told her. The guards sometimes like to play their music real loud. It's fine. Go back to sleep.
The heavy beat gave way to a popular song that Valentina recognized from the radio.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy?
But then she became aware of another sound. It was emanating from somewhere out there in the dark.
It was a scream. A woman's scream.
Chapter 39, August 1998. Franco had barely spoken a word since arriving at Abuelo's apartment. After opening and closing the window in my father's bedroom a couple of times, he ended up leaving it partially open. Pacing about, inspecting the room, he pulled out a storage box from underneath the bed and brought down an old chest from the top of my father's closet. Kneeling in front of the box, he took out each object as if he were a curator handling rare artifacts. Some pieces he held up to the light to better examine. With others, he looked to me for an explanation. He pulled out a few report cards written in blue fountain pen on pink paper, school essays, a polo ball signed illegibly. He showed me an old photo of my dad and Prince Charles after a polo match at Cambridge University. I remember hearing that the prince had invited my father to England after they met at a friend's campo in Pergamino. I shrugged in response. What was there to say? My father had always lived a charmed existence.
Unlike Franco, I had been reckless in my methods, emptying drawers, pulling most of the books off the shelves, leafing through them, and turning them upside down. A trail of items had been carelessly strewn across the bed and floor. I had been bursting with manic energy, certain we would find another piece of information connecting my father to Valentina or Maximo. Tired and hungry, I plopped myself down on my father's bed. I felt foolish for having raised my hopes.
Franco?
Hmm?
He was lost in a stack of papers.
This was a stupid idea.
We're probably not going to find anything here if we haven't already. Aren't you hungry? Should we go somewhere to eat?
I'd rather stay in if you don't mind. There's a lot more to go through, he said, clearly absorbed by the task.
I slid off the bed, leaving the room and Franco to his research. In the kitchen, I opened the fridge and checked its contents. A tray of empanadas prepared by Abuelo's housekeeper was on the top shelf. Lifting the foil, I found a note with instructions on heating and a list of the turnover's fillings. Creamed corn, ham and cheese, spicy beef. I turned on the oven and arranged an assortment of 8 empanadas on a flat aluminum sheet. Franco was tidying up when I returned to the bedroom.
Thanks for cleaning up my mess.
I'm not much of a detective, am I? I said. He smiled and nodded before picking up some books off the bed.
Come up with anything else?
No,
he said, fitting another book back onto the shelf.
I put some empanadas in the oven.
I'll be right there.
Back in the kitchen, I took a corkscrew from one of the drawers. A glass of wine would calm my nerves. I returned with a bottle of Malbec from the wine rack when Franco walked up behind me.
Can I help? He asked.
Grab a couple of wine glasses? They're in the glass cabinet in the dining room.
Are we celebrating something?
He asked.
I saw lighted candles on the table.
I poured us each a glass. My mind keeps going around in circles, and I'm not getting anywhere. It's exhausting.
It is a lot, Paloma.
Feeling like I might cry, I took a deep breath. So tonight, we celebrate you, I said, raising my glass. Here's to you, for all you've done for me. I tipped my glass toward him and drank. Long and deep. I could be facing this all alone, or I might not have ever learned the truth. But I'm not alone. You're with me. And I'm grateful to you for that. I'll never forget what you did for me, Franco.
Okay. You're welcome. My pleasure.
He frowned a little.
But I'm a bit confused. Is this some sort of goodbye speech?
It's not meant to be one, I said, taking in a mouthful of wine. The liquid went down warm and smooth. On the contrary, I was going to see if you wanted to stay here tonight.
That's what I'll always remember about you.
What?
You were the first woman to ever ask me out, and now you're the first woman to ask me to spend the night.
Is that how he saw me? His grin told me he was teasing. Let the record show, Mr. Bonetti, that you're the first guy I've asked out for a drink and also the first guy I've asked to spend the night. I emptied my glass. Lately, I've been doing things I never imagined in a million years. But the truth is, I don't want to be alone tonight.
I don't want you to spend the night alone either, he said,
taking my glass and setting it down.
So you'll stay?
I asked, recalling the last time he was in my apartment and his abrupt departure.
There's nothing I'd like more,
he murmured as his lips gently kissed mine. He wrapped his arms around me, and the warmth of his body traveled straight to my splintered heart. I closed my eyes, filled my nose with his scent.
All night?
If you want me to.
I do.
He found my mouth again. His kiss made me quiver with pleasure, and I leaned into him. His hands moved down to my hips, and I slowly began to lose sense of my surroundings. Suddenly, my stomach made a funny sound, and with our lips still pressed together, we both grinned. Not a very delicate sound from a not-so-delicate lady, I said, laughing, a little embarrassed. The only food I had eaten all day was Luis's churros.
Hungry?
Starved. I'll finish setting the table.
You should find everything you need in the dining room.
He left, and I brought my attention back to the empanadas. The oven released a delicious aroma, and I pulled out the tray with a pair of oven mitts. I poked open one of the empanadas, letting steam escape. They were ready. It was my first time cooking in the apartment, and this ordinary activity was a welcome distraction. Franco returned to the kitchen, holding a white tablecloth. I found this folded away in one of the drawers. We laid it out across the table. Its borders were yellow from age. The words, Café de las Artes, were embroidered in red along the bottom edge of the tablecloth. In the center, in bold script, someone had written, Universidad de Buenos Aires, class of 1975. Franco brought over our glasses of wine, and together we analyzed the old tablecloth. Names were written all over the fabric.
What's up with all the signatures?
It's a university tradition. Classmates meet on the last day of classes to drink, eat, and sign their names on a tablecloth. Franco examined the tablecloth until he found what he was looking for. His finger landed on a slanted signature.
See? Your father got to keep this one.
Ah, yes. That's his.
We drank and ate while scanning the various signatures. There were easily 20 to 30 names. My eyes were drawn to one with the first name that began with a G and the last name that began with a D.
Those initials. It had to be Grace Diaz.
Excitedly, I showed Franco.
I bet that signature belongs to my father's friend. She's the one who first mentioned Máximo to me. Her maiden name is Grace Diaz. GD.
Trying to decipher the scribbled names proved to be a challenging task. Many of the signatures may as well have been chicken scratch. I was about to suggest we take a break and eat, when Franco pointed to a name near the bottom right-hand corner. Unlike most, this signature was easy to read. It was beautifully written, as if penned by a calligrapher. I read out loud.
Máximo Cassini.
Chapter 40. May, 1976. By the standards of Argentina's vast geography, Conrad Robertson's land was reasonably close to the Larrea's ranch, and when invited for an afternoon tea with Alfonso and Constanza, the British gentleman who had danced with Lila at the farmer's ball flew over in his single-engine plane. So when Santiago phoned him on a Sunday, inviting him for tea at El Pinar, he was sure that Conrad made nothing of it. The opportunities to socialize were relatively few in the Pampas, a stark contrast to Conrad's former life as an embassy attaché, which he had abandoned after marrying an Anglo-Argentine with a sizable estate that needed tending to.
Santiago, lovely to be here. And your parents? Are they resting?
Conrad asked him after being shown to the library. Spines of leather-bound books sat on built-in shelves along two adjoining walls. It was a large but cozy corner with two reclining chairs and reading lights. On the other side of the room were a stone fireplace and a long brown leather sofa with tartan throw blankets. Faded Persian rugs covered sections of the parquet floor. Prints of landscapes of the Scottish Highlands and an antique map of the United Kingdom belonging to the former owner decorated the remaining walls. His guest was smiling, and Santiago knew these touches made his British friend feel more at home. Conrad's thinning red hair was combed to the side,
He wore an olive-green barber jacket, a pair of dark jeans, and brown loafers. His Ray-Ban aviator glasses were tucked into his V-neck sweater. Santiago turned from the fire he had lit for the visit.
"My parents are traveling. I'm on my own," he said.
It was a half-lie. The part about his parents traveling was true. A couple of days after his mother's 60th birthday celebration, Alfonso Larrea had, as a birthday present, taken his wife for a 3-week trip to Italy. What wasn't true was the part about Santiago being on his own at the ranch. Máximo was hiding in Sanchez's home, a mere 1,500 feet from the main house.
"Please,"
Santiago said, gesturing to one of the chairs. Taking a small key from a dulled silver tray on his father's writing desk, he unlocked the top drawer and gave Conrad a compliant wink as he extracted a bottle of whiskey.
"A shot in the arm?"
he asked, and poured them each a splash into their teacups. While Conrad drank his tea, Santiago first sat, then stood, and then sat again while discussing in great detail the South American soccer tournament Copa Libertadores and his team River Plate's chances of winning. Conrad listened and offered his opinion when asked. It was only when Santiago began to dissect his soccer club's biggest rival, a Brazilian team, fidgeting all the while with his napkin and teaspoon, that Conrad finally spoke up.
"Santiago,"
Conrad said, picking up the bottle for another round.
"There is nothing I would enjoy more than to sit here, drinking tea and enjoying your father's fine spirits whilst discussing football. But am I correct in sensing there's something else on your mind?"
Santiago was quiet and then said,
"Where to begin? Is everything all right? Does it concern Leela?"
Conrad asked.
"No. God, no."
Santiago walked to the door, closed it, and turned back to Conrad.
"I know that you're no longer officially employed by the British government, but I imagine you still have your contacts." "Most of my contemporaries have moved on, but there are a few of us who check in every now and again." "Right, right. But in this case, I'm thinking it might be preferable if your contacts weren't official." "I'm not sure I follow you," Conrad said. "It would be better if you were more straightforward with me."
Santiago sat back down.
"I need a passport. A foreign one." "Are you in some sort of trouble?" "No. It's not for me. It's for a friend." "Okay. What kind of situation are we talking about?"
Conrad asked. He then instantly raised a hand.
"No, no. Better not to tell me. Where is your friend now?" "I can't say. Age? 24. To any country in particular?" "A Spanish-speaking country would be ideal, but frankly, he'll go wherever it's safe." "Understood."
Conrad rose from his chair.
"You can help me then?" "I'm not making any promises." "Fair enough, but you'll think it over?" "For the sake of my friendship with your family, yes."
As Conrad slipped on his gloves, Santiago served himself another whiskey. He took a big swallow and slowly placed the glass down.
"There may be one more, maybe two, after this one."
Conrad raised an eyebrow and took a long look at Santiago, the polo player and bon vivant. How things have changed, he thought. He said,
"I'll see what can be done."
It had been more than a week since Máximo appeared unannounced at Constanza's birthday party and back in Buenos Aires. Santiago felt like he was being submerged under the weight of Valentina's disappearance. The news of her pregnancy troubled him even more when Maximo told him he did not know her due date. It made Santiago quietly obsess over whether the baby might be his. However, he needed to keep up appearances. It was a Saturday, and drinks and dinner had been organized at one of the more fashionable restaurants of the Costanera Norte. Lila had already put on makeup and a new outfit. She had recovered emotionally from a second miscarriage after her gynecologist said that her body was ready to try again. She had also started working in a friend's new clothing boutique. For his wife, life was falling nicely into place. The steakhouse grill was of industrial size, an attractive focal point for the diners, and every table was occupied with boisterous patrons. Santiago nursed a brandy while the men chatted about soccer. Lila and her friends discussed the boutique and her possible trip to Europe to shop next season's collection. Santiago saw Grace entering the restaurant and excused himself. They kissed hello. Grace had come with her brother, Sebastian, and another woman, but the two had gone over to the bar to order drinks while they waited for their table.
Who's the woman with your brother?
I don't know. Her name is Natalia, I think.
Guessing it's not serious, then.
He lit a cigarette she extracted from her purse and placed between her lips.
Where's Isidoro?
He asked, wondering if her red-rimmed eyes had something to do with her latest boyfriend.
We're not dating anymore, she said.
I'm sorry, Grace. You deserve someone who'll treat you like a princess.
I broke it off, she announced briskly. Come with me a minute.
They went to the outdoor bar, where a breeze passed through them with the heavy scent of the Rio de la Plata.
My parents want me to leave.
What? Why?
They're worried. One of my mother's best friends had to leave. You've met her. Silvia Faure.
The painter? Sure, I know who she is.
She's in France. After making comments in an interview for a magazine about how an artist must have total freedom of expression, she started getting death threats, she said, nervously glancing about, making sure they were out of earshot.
But why you?
Enrique. His mother called me, desperate. She told me they dragged him out of his bed one night. That was over 2 months ago, and his parents haven't been able to get any straight answers.
What does Enrique have to do with you?
Valentina had told Santiago about Enrique's disappearance when he met with her at Casa de los Niños, but he didn't understand why Grace would be at risk.
We dated, in their twisted thinking. It might be enough to qualify me as a subversive, Grace said.
The armed militants had essentially been wiped out by the time of the coup, so the armed forces had expanded their definition of subversive to include anyone opposed to the new dictatorship. Whirring sounds from the evening sky made them look up. A beam of harsh light swept over them and other guests outdoors. As the curfew hour neared, it had become customary to see helicopters patrolling from above. When the helicopter moved on, Santiago asked in a low tone,
Have you been threatened?
No. But my parents don't want to take any chances.
Where would you go?
Holland. My father's friend is the owner of a beer company where my family also owns shares. If I go, I'd stay with his family. Santiago closed his eyes briefly. Valentina. Maximo. Could he tell Grace?
Of course he could confide in her. They had been friends for years.
Valentina's missing.
Grace halted, losing her balance. He caught her elbow.
Oh, God. When?
2 weeks ago. Maximo came to see me. He's hiding at El Pinar.
What are you going to do?
I'm working on getting him out of the country.
And Valentina?
I've been trying to contact General Delgado, but he's been sent as an envoy to Spain and has been impossible to reach. He may have even already.
Grace wasn't listening. Her eyes had shifted from him to the restaurant entrance. Santiago looked over his shoulder to see who or what had distracted her.
It was Pedro Garcia.
The last time Santiago and Grace had seen Pedro was in February at General Delgado's daughter's wedding. At the party, Pedro had been wearing his formal naval officer's uniform. Tonight, like the group of men accompanying him, Pedro was dressed casually, wearing a polo shirt with a V-neck sweater tied around his neck, khakis, and boat shoes. He carried a pair of sailing gloves in one hand. They must have been out on the river, Santiago thought. Grace narrowed her eyes and pursed her lips in distaste as the men approached. Santiago, on the other hand, saw an opportunity and turned to them with a friendly smile. Santiago woke up early the next morning. Pedro Garcia had said to meet at the Richmond, a grand old café on Florida Street in the city's financial district. Drinking his second cup of coffee, he wondered if he had gotten the time wrong. He hadn't. Pedro was and always would be late to their meetings, intentionally operating in direct contrast to his military training. The new relationship between the two men would take place outside the realm of Pedro's official duties, giving him freedom to do as he pleased. After he arrived and the waiter had brought him a coffee, Pedro began.
You said it was important we speak in private.
Santiago appreciated his directness and responded likewise.
A friend of mine is missing. Her parents have filed a report with the police. I was hoping you could help me. Ask your contacts within the armed forces. What makes you think we have anything to do with her disappearance? I'm only asking if you would check. I'm exploring all avenues.
Pedro added sugar to his coffee, stirred, and then took a long, leisurely sip.
What's her name? Valentina Quintero. And her war name?
Santiago drew in his breath.
She's not a member of any guerrilla organization. She's an architect who volunteers at a daycare center.
He answered in a steady voice.
Why the interest in her?
Santiago faltered.
She's someone I used to date. Did I meet her at your parents' gathering for Bautista a couple of years ago? Yes. That's her. I remember her. That was a fun night.
Pedro's expression became distracted, as if his mind was going over the good time he'd had at the party. He returned his attention to Santiago and said,
If she's done nothing wrong, she'll be released. She's done nothing wrong, and it's been more than 2 weeks now since anyone has heard from her.
Pedro had never managed to be invited into the Larrea brothers' innermost circle, and he was clearly savoring his power over Bautista's little brother. After sizing up Santiago for another moment, Pedro's voice took on a more serious tone.
I'll see what I can find out. But let it be clear that I'm doing you this favor at considerable risk to myself and my position. You are not to speak to anyone about this. Is that understood?
Pedro had quickly risen in the ranks after his graduation. It hadn't hurt that, coming from a long lineage of military men, he had been favored by Emilio Maceda, a member of the military junta, and the commander-in-chief of the Navy.
Understood.
Pedro scraped back his chair to stand.
There's something else. She's in a delicate state. She's pregnant, Santiago said.
Pedro raised an eyebrow.
Is the baby yours?
Yes, Santiago answered, feeling in his heart that it must be true.
Now I understand.
Pedro smiled. He added,
Being pregnant is helpful.
It is?
Yes. Pregnant women, mothers, they're treated differently. Better.
Santiago nodded as he processed Pedro's comment. It informed him of several things. First, that Pedro had, in effect, acknowledged the illegal detentions. Second, that he probably knew the locations of the detention centers. And third, that because Valentina was pregnant, she would be given special treatment. His instinct to tell Pedro about her pregnancy had been correct, and claiming to be the father should help his case. They would release her more quickly. When he stood to shake Pedro's hand, he was breathing more easily again. Later that day, before getting on the highway to go back to El Pinar, Santiago stopped at a payphone and contacted a number Conrad had given him, a phone number that couldn't be traced. After receiving further instructions, he went to a pharmacy. It was after dusk when he arrived at the ranch, and he immediately went to see Sanchez.
"Is he in?"
Santiago asked when Josefina opened the door to let him in. The small house appeared to be empty. "My husband wants you to meet him at the old barn," she said. Santiago hurried up the path and past the guest house, the stables, the garden shed, a garage for the tractors. On the edge of an interminable stretch of land was the final structure, an abandoned barn where spare parts were stored and out-of-commission tools were left to rust. He entered to find Maximo and Sanchez walking around the long, narrow, cluttered space. Maximo's hair had grown past his shoulders, and a beard now covered his gaunt cheeks. His friend would need a makeover before having his passport photo taken by one of Conrad's contacts. They would have to cut and dye his hair, shave his face, have him wear a pair of glasses. His appearance had to be altered as much as possible, Conrad had explained. Santiago had brought supplies from the pharmacy and clothes from his own closet.
"Santi, any news?"
Maximo asked, hugging him.
"I'm working on it,"
Santiago said.
"What's going on here?" "We were evaluating the space. Maybe if we build a false wall, we could use the last quarter of this barn, create a hiding place,"
Maximo explained.
"But I'm getting you out soon. I have confirmation that your passport is almost ready."
"Thank you. You're a good man, Santiago. And I'm sure you'll want to help others.
They'll need a place to hide. This would be ideal."
Santiago had not considered doing this for anyone else, for the simple reason that he hadn't thought beyond Valentina and her baby.
"I'm very good at building. The three of us could get this up in no time,"
Maximo added, while Santiago pondered the proposal. He remembered Grace, and wondered how many others now found themselves on the wrong side of this dictatorship, facing persecution, torture, and worse. His friend was right. He would continue to help, and would need to create a place where those who had to escape would not be found. A safe house. He turned to Sanchez, who awaited his instructions.
"Fine,"
Santiago said to the men.
"And as soon as we get this built, we're getting you out of the country."
"I want to go," Maximo agreed.
"But not without Valentina. You have to. I don't know how long it will take to get her back." "You're confident you will?"
Maximo's eyes came back to life.
"I am."
Chapter 41. August 1998. When Franco said he would stay over, I hadn't quite believed him. But then, as we cleared the plates, after finding Maximo's full name on the tablecloth, I kissed him. And when I pulled back, I saw his eyes were still closed, as if he were savoring the sensation my lips left on his. Whispering, he asked where my bedroom was. I led him to the guest room instead. He took his time. Each article of clothing unveiled a new part of my body that seemed to require quiet contemplation before moving on. When I was fully naked, He removed his glasses and continued the examination with his hands and his mouth. He was so careful and deliberate in his pursuit that I startled when he thrust himself inside of me. As I neared climax, he covered my mouth with his. He inhaled me deeply, as if he wanted to take in my pain, not wishing me to bear it alone. Afterward, he got out of bed. I slid under the covers, certain he had left. When I next opened my eyes, my body tingled with an inexplicably sweet sadness. It was Franco, caressing me. We made love again. After, in his arms, I drifted into a dreamless sleep. The following morning, with Franco still asleep in the guest room down the hall, I returned to my father's bedroom. I tackled, more carefully this time, his bookshelves. Nothing. Next, I turned to his university notebooks. These were in a box under his desk. I had barely glanced at them the night before. I would go through every page of every law class notebook if I had to. It was when I was nearing the bottom of the stack that I came across a worn notebook, thickened from overuse. The first pages consisted of class notes, descriptions of archaic-sounding laws, scribbled bullet points. Nothing meaningful. But then, drawings began to appear above and below his annotations, along the sides, as though my father were growing increasingly bored by the lectures. Caricatures of men in military uniform, political leaders. I made out Juan Domingo and Eva Perón, Fidel Castro, Che Guevara. Comic strips not quite finished. I studied them, amazed. I had no idea my father could draw. Why had he stopped? The second part of the notebook was devoid of any text, as if my father could no longer pretend, even to himself, any interest in the class. Pencil drawings of human anatomy were followed by a series of faces. Men and women, young and old, gauchos on horseback, indigenous people. And then I saw a face I recognized. It was Valentina. Suddenly, she was everywhere. Several sketches showed her looking right at the artist. Others were of her profile, her thick eyebrow flowing into the outline of her pronounced nose. In one, she was laughing, her mass of dark curls spilled over her bare shoulders, wisps of hair across her generous lips. I flipped the page to a drawing of Valentina in bed, partially covered by a sheet. Her back was to the artist, but her head was turned with a dreamy expression on her face. Feeling like I had walked in on an intimate moment between two lovers, I quickly turned to the end. And when I did, I briefly shut my eyes. After reading again the words inside the back cover, I let out a long exhale. Máximo Cassini, Calle La Rioja, 1280, Quilmes, Provincia de Buenos Aires. Once a quaint town after which Argentina's national beer was named, Quilmes had become just another neighborhood in the ring of working and middle-class suburbs around the capital. We stood in front of one, in a row of identical two-story houses. I checked the number against the address from the notebook, then gave Franco a thumbs up. When he rang the bell, an old woman answered. I smiled and began, "Good afternoon. My name is..."
"Are you selling something?"
interrupted the woman with a wary eye on Franco and me.
No. We were hoping to talk to a member of the Cassini family. Are you, by any chance, Mrs. Cassini?" I asked.
The woman hesitated.
"Yes, that's me."
"You have no idea how happy I am to hear that," I said. "I'm Paloma Larrea."
"Who's he?"
the woman asked, gesturing at Franco.
"He's my friend, Franco."
"Are you conducting a survey?"
"No, nothing like that," I clarified, smiling. But before I tell you why we're here, is Massimo Cassini your son?
The woman nodded, uncertainly. Barely able to contain my elation, I said,
My father, Santiago Larrea, was friends with your son in law school.
Who?
Santiago Larrea.
Name doesn't ring a bell. I'm sorry, young lady.
Mrs. Cassini made to close the door.
Wait!
I widened my smile. Cheerful people don't have doors shut on their faces twice, I told myself, recalling my encounter with Marcela at Valentina's old building. I held out the notebook to Mrs. Cassini and opened it to the back cover for her to see.
I found Massimo's address in this old notebook.
The photos came out next.
See here?
I pointed to Massimo on the steps of the law school. Mrs. Cassini put on her reading glasses.
And this man is my dad, Santiago. They were friends. And that's their friend Valentina.
The woman gaped at the old photos, her eyes glistening.
We'd love to talk to you about your son, if you have a moment.
I'll make some coffee, she said,
ushering us inside. While Nora Cassini prepared coffee, she invited us to wait out on the patio. It was a crisp winter afternoon. Franco brought his chair next to me and laced his fingers with mine. His smile, intimate and conspiratorial, transported me back to the night before. I smiled back. In that moment, during this strange time, I felt something akin to happiness.
Milk or sugar with your coffee?
Nora asked, setting down the tray. We thanked her, accepting a cup. She told us she hadn't entertained visitors in ages and was pleased to have company. However, our unexpected visit seemed to have the opposite effect on her husband, Enzo. After a handshake, he was off to the other end of the yard. The drop in temperature the night before had left a layer of frost on his garden, Nora explained, excusing her husband's brusque reception. Once she had offered us cookies, Nora sat and picked up the photo with the inscription on the back.
Por Valentina. May she rest in peace. A terrible loss, she said. Such a lovely young woman. We were so happy our son had found her.
I sat forward in my chair. So they were a couple?
Of course,
Nora answered and leaned forward.
They were living in sin,
she confided in a hushed tone. She glanced at Enzo trimming the shrubs.
He didn't know. Still doesn't.
So they were serious?
Yes, very much so. They were going to be married.
Oh, I see, I said, trying to conceal my surprise.
Massimo Cassini had been planning to marry Valentina. Yes, that certainly qualified as serious.
Did Massimo practice law?
He did, providing free legal services to the poor. He planned to defend political prisoners, but it didn't work out. He loved doing community service, always thinking of others,
Nora said, with a mother's pride in her voice and on her face.
Thankfully, he was also good at drawing. He was able to make a living as an illustrator.
Massimo was an illustrator? I felt a flutter in my ribcage. I didn't know my father had been an artist, because he had never been one. The sketches were not his. They were Massimo's. The notebook belonged to Massimo.
Why did my father have it?
I was anxious to go through the pages again, but something stopped me from taking it out of my purse and sharing my revelation with the others. Nora, unaware of the inner turmoil caused by her recounting, ran a hand through her short gray hair and continued.
Valentina told me herself of their plans to marry.
She motioned with her head toward the house.
We were in the kitchen preparing lunch. Valentina started off in a roundabout way, saying that Maximo wanted to visit her family in Córdoba. Not that this was unusual for them. They had gone there together in the past to spend the weekend. But then she said that he was going alone and that he wished to speak to her father. So I knew instantly what she was trying to tell me. She asked me not to say anything. Maximo would tell Enzo and me when he returned. I remember how we giggled, like two schoolgirls sharing a delicious secret.
What a special moment that must have been for you, Franco said. I apologize in advance, but we need to ask you a question, Senora. Is your son still alive?
Nora looked at him, perplexed.
Of course. Why in heaven's name would you think he's dead?
I'm really sorry. We didn't know and needed to confirm.
May God keep him safe,
Nora answered somberly. Does he live in Buenos Aires? I asked.
Oh, no, she said, clicking her tongue. He left long ago, moved to France in 1976 when things got difficult here. It was very hard on him after she was taken. It was hard on all of us.
Franco and I exchanged a glance at this disappointing piece of information. Our hostess, however, smiled. Even though this conversation must have been difficult for her, she was visibly delighted to have young people in her home again. Nora sat up straight in her chair.
He moved back to Argentina in 1985, after the end of the military government, but never to Buenos Aires. Too many sad memories, you know. He should be here with his mother.
We looked over to Enzo by the back fence. He had been listening the whole time.
I'm not mad that he didn't settle down somewhere near us. How could I be?
Nora replied.
Maximo needed to take care of himself.
Where does Maximo live now? I asked.
He lives in the middle of nowhere! That's where!
Enzo barked, brandishing the water can our way. Nora fixed her husband with a stare and turned back to us.
Don't mind him. Our son lives in the south, in San Martin de los Andes.
Chapter 42, May through July, 1976. Without warning, the door swung open, surprising both Valentina and the man who, seconds before, had been whistling along to a classical piece on the radio, while holding an electric prod over her chest. Blindfolded and naked, Valentina was lying down, her ankles and wrists strapped to the ends of the examining table. The only way to anticipate the pain from an electric charge to her armpits or her chest was by the man's wheezing. Musty and stale from cigarettes, his breath would suddenly be on her face. This particular torturer liked to toy with her, leaning and then retreating, laughing a little as her body went rigid, bracing itself for the shock.
You've been relieved from your duties, officer, came a command from behind her head.
But I've only just begun my session with prisoner 322,
the officer said, waving the prod as though holding a conductor's wand.
Prisoner 322 has been elevated and reassigned. She's under my direct supervision.
Valentina heard movement, the definitive sound of the door being shut. Moments passed, and then the feel of warm fingers on her cheeks, under her blindfold. She had been living in darkness since they kidnapped her and had lost track of time, living without eating or sleeping for what seemed like days at a time. What sustained her through the terror was the hope that they would release her once they understood a mistake had been made. But the hope was diminishing. The blindfold was gingerly lifted up onto her forehead. The ceiling lights blinded her, and she blinked. Her eyes watered uncontrollably. A man was studying her face. After a minute, he unbound her limbs. Why had he let her see his face? Even as her vision remained blurry, she recognized him. From where?
Here. Use this.
The threadbare towel was small, and she barely managed to cover her torso.
I think we can find something for you to wear,
he said, giving her a hand to help her off the table. He led her up the stairs to a room where confiscated items and clothes were stored, the spoils of the dirty war, as the campaign of suppression had come to be called. The man let her sit on the floor as he sifted through the pile of women's clothing. He found something he thought suitable.
Try this on.
She had lost weight, and the dress easily fit over her pregnant body. He escorted her back to her cell. She thanked him. The words of gratitude were so heartfelt that she barely gave them a second thought. That night, Valentina told her neighbor, whose name she eventually learned was Soledad, of the man and his strange behavior.
What did he look like?
Soledad asked in a whispering voice.
He's blonde, blue eyes.
Does he have a round, sweet face?
I guess so. He looks young.
A mole above his lip?
Yes.
That's El Angelito,
Soledad said, letting out a low whistle.
He must have taken a liking to you.
The next time the officer appeared, he freed her from her tomb-like cell and took her to an office down the hall. He produced from behind the desk another dress. He then handed her a pair of high-heeled shoes.
Put these on.
She did. He had correctly guessed her size.
I hear pregnant women get cravings, so I thought you and I could go out for ice cream.
He left the office to let her get ready in private. On the desk, he had laid out a hand mirror, a comb, lipstick, and blush. She had never worn makeup, but starting that day, she would learn to apply it meticulously every time he asked her to. She looked at herself in the mirror. Since he had taken an interest in her, the torturers had left her face alone. She fumbled with the blush, and the lipstick stung her cracked lips. Running a comb through her tangled curls felt futile. When he returned and saw her hair, he gave her a barrette to hold it back from her eyes.
And this. This is yours, isn't it?
El Angelito held out his arm in a fist and, as a magician might do, opened his fingers. Her pendant.
Yes.
The necklace had been ripped off her during a torture session. El Angelito had come across one of the guards dangling it between his fingers, saying he would give it to his girlfriend for her birthday. El Angelito confiscated it back. He had her turn and lift her hair. He reached his hands through her raised arms